This is Elmer Dobson, and I'm interviewing Emmett Locke at his home in Butler Township, and he tells me this is where he's born, and he's lived here all his life. He's now 78 years old, and he used to have a reputation as a boxer and a wrestler. As I remember, he used to take on all the boys of all sizes, and he won most of his bouts. He was a great neighborhood cooperator, and he's helped the Historical Association in many ways in giving us some history about Butler Township. He even has a written description of some of the things that happened in the south side of Butler Township, which I'm going to ask him to read after I question him a little bit. Emmett, do you know when your family first moved into Butler Township?
My mother was born. She come here with her father when she was born in a log cabin on a little lake east of Fremont. And she come here with her folks in when she was 6 years old.
That would be about when?
About
1873. And the farm has been in the lock...
It originally was Ball, Charlie Ball, and his father and his brother come here from New York State and bought from a land grabber from American Land Company, and one brother took the 120 that now is in Speaker's name, and the other brother took this place of mine.
Mm-hmm. And what were their names, do you remember?
Charlie Ball and Will Ball.
All right. Where did your dad come in then?
He was born in a little town by Detroit, Plymouth. It was a little town at that time.
Well, did he buy from these people then?
He eventually did. Grandfather Alexander bought it from this Uncle Charlie Ball when he was health and failing, and then he turned right around and sold it to my father in 18 either 94 or 95.
Was it the same acreage there is now?
Exactly.
It hasn't changed. No. That's very unusual. How many acres is it?
This is 80 here.
80 acres. Of course, you have no idea what he paid for it.
Yes, I don't remember exactly, but I believe it was $2,200
for the 80.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did he have to clear quite a little land, or was
it was pretty well cleared, but there was several potholes, and the stream that runs across it meandered around in various areas. And he straightened that stream and tiled the potholes out till we've got reasonably nice fields now.
Did he have any trouble with snakes or anything of that kind?
No. You know, as a boy, we fished Hog Creek almost from one end to another.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never seen a rattlesnake or a massasauga alive in this area of my life.
The reason I asked that was Alvy Lampman said that when his dad first moved on that one piece of high ground on their farm where the house is, that there were so many rattlesnakes that killed off his dogs, and the only thing he could do, he fenced it and turned in hogs to clean up the rattlesnakes before he could move on.
Yeah. Well, right north of us, it's only a couple or 3 miles, and they've always had plenty of rattlesnakes or saugers, so-called, mm-hmm. there. But here, we never seem to have them much. Now, west of us, I've heard my uncle tell they was cleaning up some marshland that belonged to the old Peary farm, And every log that they turned over, there was rattlesnakes under it. And he and Frank Ball, that would be Harry Ball's father, they were quite buddies. And they were working there, and they spent half of their time killing rattlesnakes.
Your father's name was what?
Charles.
Charles. And his father, your grandfather?
Leonzo.
Leonzo. And evidently, you didn't have too much trouble making a good living on this place and raising a family of 8 children. Did you work mostly on the farm, or did you work away from the farm, son?
All the earlier years, I worked on the farm, raised melons, cabbage, peddled them in towns over the country, kept an older man, which you didn't have to pay much them days, to do chores and look after things while I was gone. And that helped make a living for all of us.
I did a little of that myself. It was kind of hard work, too.
Yeah, it was hard work. I've thought about it since. I wouldn't go far today with it.
No, that's true. Who helped you on this history that you wrote of Butler Township?
Marie Daniels. And she was an angel at this job.
And Marie is a neighbor?
Yes.
And she's a little handicapped physically too, isn't she?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I never could have done it without her.
Okay. I think that we should have this on tape in your own words. And if there's anything there that you feel you should skip, why, go ahead. But otherwise, let's put that on tape.
Well, I'll start the very first of it, and then if we skip some, it'll be through the middle.
Okay.
She states here, "One day must not go by without putting down on paper for posterity the thoughts of Emmett Locke, a lifetime resident of Section 28, Butler Township, Branch County, Michigan, now 76 years young. It was indeed a privilege and a delightful pleasure to lend a helping hand to Mr. Locke in preparing the enclosed detailed map, included in this short resume of Section 19 through 36 of the south one half of Butler Township are some of the trials and tribulations of the early settlers of this union, which has been passed down from generation to generation. There were 2 post offices in this small area, one at Faxon and one or the other at South Butler. The Faxon post office was one on the northwest corner of the presently named Bidwell and Quincy Grange Road. The postmistress was Mrs. Ambrose David, Jenny Faxon. This post office served a few inhabitants of this wooded area in the early years, about 3/4 of a mile east of the Faxon post office, below Wilmer's Hill. Hog Creek passes under the Bold Bridge, with Knowlesville nestled in the valley. That area now belongs to Elmer Dobson. Situated there was a blacksmith shop and a Knowlesville sawmill run by the swiftly flowing Hog Creek, where Lindsley Road made a right angle and met Craft Road. The mill race and portions of the dam remain visible today. In 1881, Gilbert Clisby and family lived on the hill west of Knowlesville, but Simon moved and Horace Wilmer purchased the farm, and for many, many years it has been known as Wilmer's Hill. Well, now let's see.
I think you got plenty of time to read it all. Right.
The South Butler Post Office was located on the South Butler Road, 1.5 miles east of Quincy Grange Road, serving the settlers in that area. Letters were a luxury in pioneer times. Travel was by wagon trail in the early days. One trail originated 1/2 mile of the Faxon Post Office on the Charlie Locke farm, the father of Emmett Locke, and followed the wooded highway grounds across a small creek on the Locke farm, where remains of stone crossings are visible today. Through the Speaker property, crossing Dean Road, the Ferguson 40, passing three early settlers' homes on the trail, and on west through Girard Township and into Girard for supplies. Aged apple trees still stand where one house was located on this wagon trail of yesterday year. 1 mile north of the Faxon Post Office, Dayburg Road intersects before one sees Hog Creek through in Dayburg Bridge. In 1848, a half-acre site was conveyed to the First Baptist Church of Butler for a meeting house and burial grounds, which is west of the present church. The original church became inactive, and a quarter acre of land was purchased on the east, the present Dayburg Church being built on that site in 1898. The church is a very flourishing worship center today, and after accepting the gift of 1/2 acre of land on the east of the present church property, from Don Farrell in 1975, a large addition is in the process of being built today. Originally, the Dayburg Burying Ground was adjacent to the church, but due to the high water level in 1862, was moved 1/2 mile north in a quiet and scenic setting on a hill overlooking the creek. About 1/2 mile west of the church lies 50 acres in section 29, now belonging to Cecil and Ruth Farrell. On this property is a grave site of one of the early woodsmen. No stone marked the grave, but his comrades planted 4 hard maple trees, one of each corner of the grave, as a living memorial. On August 16, 1845, Finnis Day sold a small plot to School District 4 in the northwest corner, section 29, but no record can be located as to whether a schoolhouse was built on this site. In 1860, Matthew M. and Opal Fox gave a 1/2 acre site to District 4, located 1 mile west of the Dayburg Church in section 19. But no record of holding school is available until 1867, when Ira G. Blankman was a winter school teacher with boys and young men attending school. And Jenny DeBois was a summer school teacher with the girls and young ladies attending. After serving the district for nearly 100 years until October 1960, the schoolhouse was sold and moved from the premises, with the land reverting back to the present owners of the property, David and Marie Daniels. However, 13 beautiful hard maple trees remain to grace the location where 3 generations of the area learned reading, writing, and arithmetic. North of the schoolhouse is a faithful winding Hog Creek, continues to flow under the Billy Holmes Bridge. The creek meanders west to Hilton's Bridge on Taylor Road, continues flowing in a westerly direction into the Coldwater River, and eventually reaching the St. Joseph River. Traveling across Billy Holmes Bridge north to East Girard Road, you come to the boundary line of these southern sections of Butler Township. As one turns east in days of yore to visit the Dean Blacksmith Shop, it was necessary to ascend the Tom Dean Hill. The blacksmith shop has disappeared along with many fond memories, but the Tom Dean Hill remains. The Indians stored grain in caves along the high banks of Hog Creek. 2 caves were located southwest of the Billy Holmes Bridge, and 2 more were located southwest of the Dayburg Bridge. Many Indians artifacts were found by the early settlers. In storing grain in these bridges, remember, Indians stored things in baskets. It wasn't just thrown in on the dirt. One wonders today why the creek was so named, but early settlers have the following explanation. A South Butler settler was herding his beechnut and acorn-fattened hogs to the recently built railroad at Quincy for shipment to market. Arriving at the river where the Lampman Bridge now stands, the hogs refused to cross. Taking each hog by the tail with the aid of a buggy whip, he forced them across the river one by one. Another settler and his wife were traveling by horse and buggy into Quincy, saw the farmer forcing his hogs through the creek, but continued on to Quincy. Upon return at night, the settler was still forcing hogs across the river. Thus became the name Hog Creek. In 1840, charcoal made from the plentiful hardwood forests of oak, beech, hickory, and hard maple was used in an iron ore smelting plant located in Section 35. The Butler Township area was originally covered with heavy timber, and as the land was cleared, drained, and cultivated, small patches were fenced and farmed, pasturing the unfenced areas. Traveling through this area today, one views well-groomed farm homes and very productive farm ground. This small area has also produced many fine citizens who were scattered throughout the country in various walks of life of which any community could be proud. The short resume of Section 19 through 36 was written by Marie Danner with material furnished by Emmett Locke, both residents of Butler Township.
Very good, Emmett. Things have changed quite a little when we stop and look at Hog Creek today. Do you know how many farmers are irrigating out of Hog Creek now?
I don't know how many, but I know they're doing it.
I understand there's about 18 or something like that.
Is that right?
And more coming. Tell us something about what did you have for tools in the early days?
Their plow was a wooden beam made out of either oak, white ash, or hard maple. And the oxen was pretty well gone in my day, although there were two or three teams that I remember seeing.
Didn't you tell me that a little earlier, though, you had talked with somebody that said there was only a few horses and mules and all the rest were oxen?
That's right. In Girard Township, the very first settlers, I was told by old Mr. Tompkins, that they were three teams of mules, either two or three barns, and 13 or 14 ox teams in the township of Girard. Butler was also in those first days included in Girard Township by the records.
Did you have dairy cows?
I used to have quite a nice herd of Jersey cows.
And how did you dispose of your milk?
And before the big depression struck, we were shipping milk into Detroit for distributing purposes and received a real nice price, way above the ordinary price. But after the big depression struck, that went haywire. Then I skimmed milk, fed hogs and calves.
You say skimmed milk. You had a cream separator?
That's right.
What was the make of that?
De La Valle.
De La Valle.
One of the oldest companies.
That's right. And considered one of the best.
Yes, it was.
Who picked up your milk that went into Detroit? Did you have a regular hauler?
Yes. He had been a cream hauler.
And what about your telephone line in those days? Did you own your own telephone line?
We owned our own telephone line after we got the phones. As a little boy, I can remember when my father and Ed Hamilton brought in either 13 or 14 phones on their sleigh that night and laid them out on the dining room floor. And it was something for me to look at and think that I was going to be able to talk over them phones.
Do you still have your phone?
Yes. Yes. Looks altogether different than those did.
I have a couple of those old wall phones myself. Then what did you do for handling your grain? Did you have a binder in those days?
Yes. They've had a binder ever since I can remember, a grain binder.
Mm-hmm.
We cut it, shocked it, and we changed around with the neighbors, about 10 of us generally, drew it up to a thrashing machine, put it in bags, put them on our shoulders, and dumped them in a bin.
The young folks always had to handle the grain, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Picked out the young men to carry the grain. Sometimes it was upstairs.
Yeah, a lot of those bins were underneath the stairway. You walked the top of the stairs and then dumped it down, and that utilized the space under the stairway.
Yeah.
Well, what were some of the other things? You didn't have electricity in those days. What did you use for light?
Well, it's called hand lamps. Burned kerosene in them. And I can remember old Mr. Hamilton, one of the first settlers in this country, he didn't give up his candle. He'd go around in his old log house. He stayed down there a lot of the time. He lived with his son since I could remember. But he'd stay down there a lot of the time, go peeking around with his candle held up over his head and shoulders to examine whatever he wanted to.
Well, could he see well enough with that to read, or didn't he have anything to read?
That I don't know. I never see him reading. He was a real sociable, nice old gentleman.
There wasn't too much to read in those days.
No, no, they wasn't.
Your plow then was a walking plow, you say, and
yes.
How long did you use that before you got to ride it?
Well, probably 1917 or 18, we bought a riding plow. But lots of times I still used the walker. In fields where there was fast stone, it was kind of a skill. You could just maneuver that walking plow around and on over it, and you'd hardly know there was a stone there.
How did you plow your fields in those days? Did you begin at the outside one year, and the next year begin in the center and work out?
That's right.
Yeah. Were you good enough at it? So I know I had an uncle that would start in the center of a 30-acre field, and he never had to make an extra trip around the outside. He would come out even every time. And he was a real artisan with the walking plow.
True. Now, that took figuring. I didn't do as good as he did. But now I had it down pretty good. I didn't have much finishing up to do. While the distance is short in the middle of the field when you're plowing, is the time to pace off from there to the fence. Then get your, if you've got to make a few moves or more furrows, they're short furrows. And then if you kind of keep a little track, you'll come out awful close.
How did you manage the width of the cut with the walking plow?
Well, there was a clevis on the front of the beam, and you adjusted that back and forth to narrow your furrow or widen it.
Couldn't you also tilt the plow to get it to cut deeper or shallower?
No. No, it was gauged by a wheel on the front end of the beam. And you lowered, if you wanted to go deeper, you raised the wheel a notch or so and bolted it back. And if you wanted to shallow up, you pressed the wheel down. That raised and tilted and raised and lowered the front end of your beam.
How'd you handle your manure?
Most of it, I throwed it on with a fork and throwed it off with a fork. Later on, I did buy a spreader.
Mm-hmm. Some of the folks used to haul it out in dump boards, and then they had what we called a hook, and they hooked it out in piles and left it out in the field, and while they were resting the horses, well, they spread the manure. Did you ever do that?
I did quite a lot of that when I was a boy, yeah. I was pretty active and strong. I'd jump right, stay right on that load, and I could pretty near spread it by the time I'd take off the sideboards and pull it into piles along on the field. So I did that mostly until I finally got to buying manure spreaders.
Have you, of course, some of my earliest recollections was seeing you around at the fairs and celebrations. Wrestling or boxing with these fellas that came in the show, and they'd give a fella so much to stay so many rounds with them. Do you have any idea how many of those bouts you got into?
No, several. Some of them I wished I hadn't got in, but they're away.
Some of those guys are pretty good.
Well, they had to be good to take on all comers, you know.
But for your inches, you stood pretty good with most of them.
I sure did. I tell you, my uncle was watching me one time, and he certainly was proud of me.
Well, I think all of Quincy was. Did you ever handle a cradle?
No. I've handled scythes quite a bit, opening up fields. But now my father was an awful good hand with a cradle. When he was still alive, he'd take his cradle and go into the grain field and open it up so as I wouldn't knock down the grain, opening up the field with a team and binder. But I myself, I never handled a cradle. Afterwards, I'd just take the scythe and open up at the gateway till I got my binder set up, then I'd drive over the grain. I didn't have time.
Well, I think most of us did that, as far as that's concerned. What's the first... We had a thrashing separator, then we came to the
combine.
What was the first combine that you ever remember?
The first combine that I see in operation was owned by Martin Luce. He lived on Dayburn Road at the time, owned a farm there. And he got the first combine that I ever see in operation.
And what, was it ground driven or what, did it have a motor?
It was motor driven.
Motor driven. Clark Winarthrick had a picture of one that was, they used out west when he was out there the first year after he got out of school, and that one was pulled by 33 horses.
And I have seen pictures of them.
And that was ground driven.
Yeah.
I had never seen one previous to that.
I never see one. I just see it in pictures.
Well, there's been a lot of changes.
They certainly have.
And I think you and I have probably seen the big bulk of the changes, don't you think so?
I have often thought about that. How could the area or the world change anymore? You and I both can remember when there wasn't more than 3-4 cars in Branch County.
Oh, yes.
And now we've seen them, pictures of them going to the moon.
Now, you went to school where?
I went to school in Quincy High School.
Quincy High School. And did you play football, or didn't they play football?
No, then? I didn't play there. I had my football playing days at Parrish Institute in Big Rapids.
Mm-hmm. What position did you play there?
Well, we played the whole game. We didn't have...
you play guard, tackle, backfield, or ran?
Offense, I played right back, right half, it them
mm-hmm.
days.
That's right.
And on defense, they had me right up in the line as tackle. I was short and weighed 170 pounds, and they didn't run over me good.
I was short and weighed 110. They tried to run over me good. Well, did you graduate from Ferris?
No. I just went there for one winter. To take a commercial course and world history and some things that I hadn't picked up. See, I only went 1 year to Quincy High School. I had rheumatic fever. And the next year, the doctor thought it would be good for me to spend it in a warmer climate. And so the folks and I drove through to Florida. And I want to say that the roads were something different than what they are now. We were 3 weeks going to Florida, down to Miami that fall.
Did you have to open gates and one thing and
another? Yes. And no signs. You took the road that you thought would be it. It looked a little more traveled than the other road. You took that, and generally you come out right.
Were they marked out like they did in the West with white stones occasionally?
No, I don't recollect of any of that. What I do recollect, down through the Virginias and some of Pennsylvania, they didn't know what a bridge was. you drove right through a creek and hoped that you didn't drown out. And by the time you went through it, you killed your motor out, and you had to sit on the other side until it dried out to go on. And then if it was too big to drive through, they had a one or two car little ferry and a cable run across. And they pulled you across on that. If the wind was blowing down river pretty strong, they asked you to get in there and help them.
Didn't most of the bridges around on Hog Creek have a place where you could drive in to set your wagon tires and your buggy tires?
All of them did. I've done it many a time. Yes. That was before they graded the roads up.
That's right. And this soil here of yours, what type of soil is it?
Well, it's a timbered soil. But it's high enough, the most of it, so it has natural drainage. And what isn't, we have it tight.
Is it underlaid with water gravel?
Some of it is, yes. And some of it is some of the best subsoil in the world. I don't know if I can tell you just what it is, but it will let water through it slowly. And it still will hold, like the seepage from manures and vegetation.
Mm-hmm.